A Washington man pleads guilty to murdering his 3-year-old son in Montana. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the owner of a dog mistakenly shot by a wolf hunter plans to sue. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about a new bus service between Missoula and the Flathead and Mission Valleys. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a health expert about Montana's ability to handle a major outbreak of infectious disease. A Washington state man has pleaded guilty to murdering his 3-year-old son in a remote Montana field. Jeremy Brent Kramer of Lacey told District Judge Lauren Tucker today he is ready to take accountability for the July 8th death of his son, Broderick. The 38-year-old Kramer said he wanted to get it over with, and whether his sentence is 8 years or 80 years, his son is not here. Kramer pleaded guilty to deliberate homicide. Prosecutors say he took his child from their home and drove to southwestern Montana, where he killed the boy in a field 5 miles from the town of Anaconda. Public defender Sherry Stradler says a plea agreement recommends a sentence of life in prison with no parole restrictions. A sentencing date has not been set.
And in other news from around the state, a search for a missing Denver man whose pickup was found at a trailhead northeast of Helena will resume in the spring after a weekend search failed to turn up any sign of the man. The Independent Record reports searchers on horseback with dog teams and in helicopters spent Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday looking for 52-year-old Dale Brownlow. His sister, Carol Matthews, says her brother had been staying at a Helena motel since August and was paying by the day. The wildlife biologist last paid for his room on November 28th. Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton says the weekend search did not offer any indication of where to concentrate the search. Dutton says he does not believe Brownlow is still alive. Officials plan to search again when the snow melts.
The owner of a Malamute mistakenly shot by a wolf hunter says he plans to sue. This after law enforcement agencies decided not to press charges. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
49-year-old Missoula resident Lane Spence says he still thinks about the day.
Even this morning, woke up and the vision is so vivid in my head.
It was mid-November. He was hiking with his 3 Malamutes on Lolo Pass. He heard gunshots and saw one of his dogs, little Dave, get hit in the leg.
So I'm screaming at the top of my lungs to stop shooting.
But he says the man in camouflage with what Spence says was an assault rifle did keep shooting until he killed little Dave. Spence confronted the man, who said he thought it was a wolf. He says the hunter asked if there was anything he could do, but Spence says he was distraught and told him to leave. Spence called the Missoula County Sheriff's Office to report the incident, but after an investigation, the Sheriff's Office said there did not appear to be criminal activity. Spence finds that hard to believe.
The guy shooting within 50 yards from you, towards you, when you're that close to your dog and it's not criminal endangerment?
The sheriff's office turned the case over to the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Spokesman Ron Ossheim says the situation is tragic, but there's nothing the department can do, largely because it was harm to a pet, not livestock or wildlife.
We have lots of empathy, and I'm not just saying that, we do. The fact is we have to follow the law, and the individual that was involved didn't break a law that we're responsible for, and that's, as trite as maybe that sounds, those are the facts.
Ossheim says he hopes this incident itself does spread awareness to both hunters and those hiking with animals during hunting season. Spence's lawyer, Bill Rettig, says it's not clear exactly what the civil lawsuit will entail, if it will just include the hunter, whose name hasn't been released, or if it will expand to include Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, or the state.
If indeed something is brought, it's likely going to be a negligence action against the hunter, which may or may not include the financial reimbursements.
Rettig says the lawsuit would be filed in the next month. The Malamute's owner, Lane Spence, says he would also like to push for legislation to seek stronger punishments for this kind of mistake. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Protesters trying to slow a mega load of refinery equipment destined for the tar sands in Canada used people chained together in a disabled car and a trailer for roadblocks in eastern Oregon, but authorities say the obstacles were cleared in about 2 hours. Grant County Sheriff Glenn Palmer says 16 people from Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and California were arrested last night in the town of John Day, Oregon, on charges of disorderly conduct. Portland Rising Tide spokesman Stephen Quirk says the moving company should expect, quote, further resistance all along the route, end quote, as public awareness grows about how burning tar sands for energy adds to climate change. From John Day, the load is headed across southern Idaho, then north through Montana into Alberta.
The Federal Surface Transportation Board says BNSF Railway can require coal shippers to use certain methods to reduce the amount of coal lost from rail cars leaving coal mines from Wyoming to Montana. In a decision last Wednesday, the board said shippers challenging the railway's coal loading rules had not shown the majority of measures to be unreasonable. However, it did find one provision related to liability unreasonable. BNSF spokeswoman Courtney Wallace said today the board's decision ensures coal dust stays in the rail cars where it belongs. Environmental and other groups have raised concerns about coal dust from trains as proposed projects in Washington and Oregon aim to ship millions of tons of coal by train from the Powder River Basin of Montana and Wyoming for export to Asia. BNSF's new rule requires coal to be loaded in a bread loaf shape and sprayed with one of several approved topper agents.
Former Governor Brian Schweitzer is giving a talk to a liberal advocacy group in Iowa tomorrow and has told a conservative magazine he's interested in running for president, though he hasn't made a decision. Michael Warren is a staff writer for the Weekly Standard magazine. He says he became interested in doing a profile of Schweitzer when he saw him recently on national television.
I guess the moment I thought, hey, I should write something on this guy or at least find out a little more was I saw a clip of him on MSNBC on a weekend TV show there, and he was just doing an interview and talking about his views on healthcare reform and the Democratic Party and, you know, the things that he did as governor of Montana, and I thought, hey, this guy sounds like he wants to run for president.
A recent poll in Iowa shows Schweitzer ranked far behind presumed frontrunner Hillary Clinton in a Democratic primary. Clinton has also not yet announced her intentions. News director Sally Mock will have a feature interview with the Weekly Standard's Michael Warren about the presidential race tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes are stepping up to fill a transportation gap between Flathead, Mission, and Missoula Valleys. The bus service between Missoula and the Flathead stopped last March when a federal organization found the buses running the route didn't meet federal standards. Katrin Fry reports the tribe taking over the route marks an expansion to its existing bus service.
Flathead Transit started running from Missoula to Whitefish on December 16th, right in time for end of school and the holidays.
And that's what we wanted to do, is get started so the students could get away back and get away to and from Kalispell.
Corky Sias is the transit manager for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, which runs the on-reservation tribal transit as well as Flathead Transit. Transit Section Superintendent David Jacobs with the Montana Department of Transportation says the tribes are filling a gap in a route his office has received numerous calls about.
We don't really put a value on, you know, the number of trips. We just know that every trip is important and we need to provide that service.
Jacobs says Rimrock Stages was handling bus service from Missoula to Kalispell, but he says it was shut down by the Federal Motor Carrier Service Administration for noncompliance last March.
We were waiting to see if Rimrock Stages was going to actually get back into compliance with Federal Motor Carriers, and if they did, then we could return to using them as a service provider. But it turned out over through the whole investigation eventually that Rimrock Stages was no longer going to provide service for the state of Montana. And so we had to pursue other avenues and look for another provider who would pick up that route.
Saya says the tribes have been operating a bus system across the Flathead Reservation in the Mission Valley for 7 years.
We mostly serve mostly doctor appointments. We don't do any leisure going to shopping or anything like that.
Saya says they also have grant funding to run the bus to get people to and from work 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. He says last year they had 50,000 riders and drove 700,000 miles.
We actually are one of the largest tribal transits in the nation, and we provide a lot of miles.
Saya says they have 22 16-passenger wheelchair-accessible buses. By expanding coverage to the Missoula-Whitefish route, Saya says they will be operating on a 7 days-a-week schedule. The tribes partnered with Greyhound for the service, and tickets will be available at Greyhound ticket locations. It's an 18-month pilot project.
We want to make sure this is going to work, and with the ridership and with the funding from MDT and Greyhound matching our funds for our grants because all of our grants are required to have match, and Greyhound has provided that.
Saya says a one-way ticket from Whitefish to Missoula costs $31. He says they had a good start on Monday, with 5 riders taking tickets north and 3 heading south. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Thieves have rustled 3 life-sized steel horse sculptures from a herd of 39 installed on a hill north of Three Forks in southwestern Montana. Belgrade sculptor Tom Dolan tells the Bozeman Daily Chronicle he went out to the display with a professional photographer yesterday and discovered the sculptures of 2 horses and a colt were missing. He believes they were taken within the previous week. The horses were anchored to the ground, and Dolan says it appears the thieves hammered them out and moved them with carts. The sculptures weigh between 250 and 450 pounds. Dolan estimates the missing ones are worth a total of $50,000 to $60,000. Dolan says he made the horses as a gift to the people of Montana. They were installed in September. The Broadwater County Sheriff's Office is investigating.
The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the nonpartisan not-for-profit Trust for America's Health released a report this week showing most of the nation is not prepared to handle major outbreaks of infectious disease. The Outbreaks, Protecting America's from Infectious Diseases report finds the nation's ability to prevent and control outbreaks of infectious disease is hampered by limited resources and outdated infrastructure. Montana, along with Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Nevada, and Wyoming, scored 3 out of 10 on key indicators of policies and capabilities to protect against infectious disease threats. 34 states scored a 5 or lower. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Trust for America's Health Deputy Director Rich Hamburg explains maintaining necessary funding is always challenging.
Yeah, so you know, we're seeing decreases in public health funding across all states. The federal government, you know, discretionary health funding has been cut, you know, double digits just in the last couple of years, certainly since 2010, 2011. And at the state level, we saw cuts in 33 states. Now, a small cut in Montana this year is 1.8%, but a cut nonetheless. Overall, in a report that we put out earlier this year, looking at trends, we found that 29 states had decreased funding in the past fiscal year, 23 states 2 years in a row, 14 states 3 years in a row. So, you know, when we're trying to be better prepared for more outbreaks and more serious outbreaks, and to think that we are providing less resources is troublesome. You know, overall, we've seen a cut in 40,000 public health staff at the state and local level over the last 10 years. So that's one of the things we worry about.
If you had to make a guess, why do you think are these funding levels being cut like this? Is it just simple, you got to balance the book somehow?
Yeah, well, keep in mind that the federal government, for example, and that's, you know, where 50% of public health money comes from for state and local health departments, we've seen across-the-board cuts through sequestration. And sequestration is random. It's you know, by definition, it's across the board. So, you know, there's no prioritization involved in that. You know, we've also seen, you know, major cuts in you know, efforts to balance the budget and cut the deficit. In addition, CDC's budget is down, you know, well over $1 billion just over the last couple of years. So, you know, when the nation's leading public health agency that focuses on in chronic and infectious diseases are receiving those cuts, that's felt at the state level because much of their money goes out to the states in cooperative agreements and grants. So it's not that these aren't priorities, but they're competing priorities now. Nothing could be more important than the nation's health. An infectious disease outbreak, you know, is serious business. And when you look at something that you know is going to happen every year, there will be an annual flu. Its severity may differ year to year. Every few decades, we'll see the threat of a pandemic flu outbreak, as we saw most recently in 2009. And the vaccination rate among adults is 40% in Montana. We actually set the bar at flu rates for those 6 months and older in Montana. That number is 41%. So 6 out of 10 residents of the state don't receive an annual flu vaccination. And then another one of the indicators is on a childhood vaccination rates. And the goal is 95% vaccination. Granted, you know, the highest vaccination rate is somewhere in the mid-70s, but Montana comes in at 60% again.
And that's for pertussis, is that what you're referring to?
That's just for the series of childhood vaccinations. For whooping cough, for pertussis specifically, the goal is 90%. It's a high in Delaware of 90.9%, a low in Texas of 77.4%. Montana comes in at 86.6%. So, you know, granted, not far below where we set the goal. But overall, no one is where we want to be. We look at HPV vaccinations, and there's three doses that are recommended. We have states coming in at 12%, you know, as high as 50, as low as 12% in HPV rates, you know, for girls getting all three doses, and Montana's at 41.6. So there's one that you're, you know, well above the curve. But one issue in this report is we have relatively low vaccination rates and routine preventive care screening rates. And from our perspective, it's all about prevention. So, you know, we're certainly going to advocate that we strengthen fundamental capabilities, having expert public health workforce, giving them the tools that they need to quickly detect, control, and treat diseases. We need to increase the number of Americans and Montanans receiving recommended vaccines. A whole set of indicators in the report are around surveillance and laboratory capacity. And two out of these three were met in Montana. You know, a lot of the mitigation of the effects of an infectious disease is around surveillance. How quickly is an outbreak detected? And that involves communications, interoperability, to make sure that we see, you know, trends and patterns. And the patterns that you're seeing are things like, you know, there are programs that monitor in you know, what prescriptions are being written, and you suddenly see an uptake in prescriptions being written that, you know, treat a particular disease. You know, that's the sentinel for, you know, to tell you where there might be an outbreak. So Montana is adequately prepared for a surge.
If we can go back to vaccines just real briefly, HPV vaccine, that's a very socially, very politically charged vaccine. And flu shots, I know people who are extremely intelligent, logical, and they do not trust the flu shot.
Yeah. I mean, the best we can say is, you know, overwhelming preponderance of the evidence is that these shots are safe. And yes, there are social factors, there are religious factors, there are political factors. You can go down the list, but serious public health organizations, leading public health experts, all find that, you know, overwhelmingly the benefits, you know, way outweigh any risks, if any. You know, vaccination rates are important for a couple of reasons. One is, like a flu vaccination is important for the annual flu, but should there be a pandemic, and we had a pandemic flu 4 years ago, but luckily less of a strain than we thought it might be, but ramping up vaccination rates, when you have a pandemic, you're looking for 100% vaccination. And if the population year in, year out is only getting vaccinated 40% of the time, there's no way to go from 40 to 100 in the event of an emergency. So, you know, that's sort of looking more long term. Than the HPV, yeah, I mean, that's been somewhat politicized. Fewer than half of the states require such vaccinations. You know, education for parents about the vaccine or funding for those vaccinations. But Centers for Disease Control, American Academy of Pediatrics, recommend that the vaccination be put in place for males and females, you know, starting 11, 12 years of age. Numerous studies showing the safety of the vaccines. Numerous studies showing the vaccines do not lead to increased sexual activity. And with that in mind, you know, the health effects are that it contributes to 20,000 new cases of cancer in women and 12,000 in men each year. And then you go back to the rates, and, you know, it's no wonder we're seeing that kind of incidence when, you know, three doses are required and the rates are, you know, Mississippi, 12.1% for HPV, 76%, the highest rate of childhood vaccination. So there's a lot that can be read into that, you know, what some of the external factors are that would cause HPV only be a 12%. But have the normal, you know, series of childhood vaccinations over a period of time have the highest rate in the country.
Well, back to your other points before I jumped in there. Montana does cover routine HIV screening under the Medicaid programs, and our public health lab does have the capacity in place to assure timely transportation of samples to the appropriate public health laboratories. So we do, Montana does pretty well there.
Yeah, that's a surge capacity issue. I don't know if we refer to it as such in this report, but we've also put out over the last 10 years an annual report even broader than this on public health emergency preparedness. And where many states fall short over time is really on the surge capacity. You know, maybe they're capable or they have the resources to deal with more limited outbreaks, but, you know, when there's something out of the ordinary that hits a hurricane, hits a pandemic flu, a tornado, that's the surge capacity. And, you know, are you able to step it up? And sometimes we measure bed capacity We measure whether there are agreements in place between, you know, different subdivisions of government to cooperate, you know, whether there are pandemic plans in place, whether those plans have been exercised. I mean, those are the kinds of indicators that we've had in the past. But, you know, this particular laboratory capacity one has found its way into, you know, numerous reports that we've put out, and it's, you know, very much a surge issue.
How concerned should we be about things like bioterrorism, the emergence of antibiotic-resistant superbugs? How prepared are we as a nation, as a planet, to deal with these things?
It's interesting. We just put a report out prior to this on prescription drug abuse. You know, looked at this just amazing, not once or twice more than previous years, but 5, 6, 7, 8, 100% increases in prescriptions for painkillers. You know, we're seeing the same thing, you know, and there's a big article, front page articles yesterday on attention deficit disorder, same thing, all those going up by hundreds of percent. Mm-hmm. And then here we have these antibiotic prescriptions use going up. I don't have the chart in front of me, but it was definitely 400 or 500% over a 10-year period. And so it's a resistance issue. A majority, frankly, of the antibiotics are being used in animals. These are animals that are then become food, and it's reducing the ability of humans to, you know, to fight some of these outbreaks. So, yeah, the idea of superbugs that are resistant to antibiotics is, you know, a big worry for sure.
Yeah, and just was it yesterday, earlier this week, the FDA pointed out its concerns about antibiotic soaps and overuse of those, and we could be...
Yeah, that was in the last day or so. Yeah, but that's why, again, the vigilance things, it's always changing. What's acceptable, what's not. I listened to a whole report this morning on multivitamins, and suddenly multivitamins mm-hmm. aren't, you know, doing what they need to do, and you have to keep revisiting. And that's the theme behind our reports, is that some reports we put out on an annual basis, some reports we put out, you know, as a snapshot, and not sure what's going to happen with this one. It's the first time we've put it out. But in the emergency preparedness reports that include these infectious disease outbreaks, you know, we're constantly raising the bar. You know, I'll use as an example pandemic flu. Prior to the outbreaks of bird flu in Asia, you know, 2005-ish, 2006, we began to, you know, to really put the word out of the importance of preparation and planning. And the indicator that we had in our report back maybe 8 years ago, I think, was as simple as, does the state have a pandemic flu plan? That was it. Does it have a plan? And I don't have it in front of me, but I'm sure a majority of states did not have a plan. And then, you know, you revisit that the next year, raise the indicator to, here's a series of criteria. Did the plans meet those criteria? Then you put in another indicator a year or two out that says, you know, have they exercised those plans and taken, you know, remediation through after-action plans? And you know what I mean? So you keep raising the bar. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make the public as knowledgeable about these issues, to call attention to where states are and where states are in comparison to each other. It's meant in the positive to promote health and nation's public health and greater investments in these programs.
Rich Hamburg, the Trust for America's Health Deputy Director. Very much appreciate your time, Rich.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Before tonight's weather, we have to correct a story we read earlier. The Belgrade sculptor whose three steel horse sculptures were stolen from the Three Forks area's name is Jim Dolan, not Tom Dolan, as we initially reported. Now for tonight's forecast. There's a winter weather advisory for snow in effect for almost all of our listening area, beginning in western Montana at about 5 a.m. tomorrow, lasting until 11 a.m. Thursday. Central Montana should expect those snowy conditions to begin about noon tomorrow and last until noon Thursday. Southwest Montana's advisory runs from 6 p.m. tomorrow through 6 p.m. Thursday. West of the Divide, there's also a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow afternoon through Thursday morning for the West Glacier region and the Flathead and Mission Valleys. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with areas of rain and snow. Low should be 16 to 23 degrees. Tomorrow, rain and snow are likely with highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's also a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow afternoon through Thursday morning for the Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade County, Shodo, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. There's also a high wind warning in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow in those same areas. Tonight, expect lows 25 to 35 degrees and wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour along the Rocky Mountain Front. Tomorrow, there's a chance of rain or snow. Expect highs in the 30s, but temperatures will drop into the upper teens in the afternoon. afternoon. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with hot lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy and highs will be 30 to 40 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Al Smith.
It's that time of year when many of us are out buying gifts as part of our holiday celebrations. The vast majority of those will be purchased with debit or credit cards. Later this month and continuing next month, the statements on those cards will be arriving in mailboxes or inboxes across the state. And if you have a dispute with the bank, such as additional fees being tacked on that you didn't know about, that caused you to go over your limit and incur even more charges, you will likely find that buried in the fine print of your account agreement is a provision requiring that all disputes with your bank must go through arbitration. Arbitration is a legal process to resolve disputes between parties without using the court system. Provisions for arbitration are usually contained in a contract between two parties. Those contract provisions set out the rules for the arbitration, including what parts of the contract will be subject to arbitration, how an arbitrator will be chosen, which of the parties will pay for the arbitration services, and where the arbitration proceeding will take place. Congress passed the Federal Arbitration Act in the 1920s as a means to enforce arbitration provisions and contracts between large corporations. At the time, that made sense. Corporations would be on roughly equal footing, having the business and legal expertise to knowingly waive the right to take disputes over contracts to court. Arbitration provisions have steadily proliferated into all contracts, to the point now where you would be hard-pressed to find a single consumer, whether they know it or not, who is not subject to a mandatory arbitration clause in a consumer contract. If you ever purchased or rented a cell phone, a car, or a computer, you probably have unknowingly waived your right to take to court a dispute about that product and agreed to mandatory binding arbitration. The same goes for services. Chances are your credit cards, bank accounts, retirement accounts, and other services have a mandatory arbitration clause that waives your right to pursue a remedy in court. Now, arbitration itself is not necessarily bad. Arbitration can be an easy, low-cost way to resolve disputes over products and services that parties can agree to once a problem arises. The problem is that when agreement to arbitration is mandatory and required before any dispute arises, the consumer is always at a disadvantage. Mandatory pre-dispute arbitration clauses can never be fair when the parties do not have equal bargaining power, equal experience in arbitration, equal ability to understand contract language, particularly the ramifications of the rights being waived, and an equal ability to insist on clauses being included or excluded in the contract. Arbitration procedures now severely weight the scales of justice towards large businesses and away from consumers, employees, and small businesses. Consumers are not on equal footing with corporations. They are presented with take-it-or-leave-it contracts, and the arbitration process is weighted in favor of the corporations. They get to choose who the arbitrator is and where the arbitration takes place, and the cost of arbitration is often oppressive. The U.S. Supreme Court of the last few years has repeatedly declined to uphold an individual's right under the Seventh Amendment to have civil disputes decided by a jury. Given the court's decisions and the financial realities that inhibit individual arbitrations, consumers have tried to band together and bring class action arbitrations. While no individual could afford to spend thousands of dollars to recover $30, thousands of consumers could find an attorney to take a case with a percentage from each consumer's $30 to pay the attorney's fee. This year, the court again sided with corporations, leaving consumers with no recourse and giving corporations an arbitration free pass. No accountability unless someone is willing to spend more money than they could ever hope to recover. Now, after all that coal in your stocking reporting, there is reason for a little cheer this holiday season. The possibility for some relief from abusive arbitration provisions for financial contracts, like bank and credit contracts. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010 charges the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau with studying the use of pre-dispute arbitration contract provisions in consumer financial products or services. The Bureau is in the process of conducting that study right now. It has compiled a preliminary study, started having public hearings last week, and proposed a course for further investigation before reporting to Congress. There is even a petition out there to urge the Bureau to stand up for consumers and fight to stop forced arbitration in consumer financial contracts. Congress is also looking at reining in forced arbitration provisions in other consumer contracts. U.S. Senator Al Franken and U.S. Representative Hank Johnson have introduced the Arbitration Fairness Act of 2013 to restore Americans' rights. The AFA would eliminate forced arbitration in employment, consumer, civil rights, and antitrust cases. Links to more information on these efforts can be found at our website, montTLA.com, or in the written version of this commentary at KUFM.org. This is Al Smith with the Montana Trial Lawyers, wishing you a Merry Christmas and a safe and happy New Year.
Al Smith is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtbr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.